Okay, this is the fifth and final shiur on the oral law. Okay. All right, today I'd like to talk about who are the people who administer the Torah as a whole, who are the people who are the repository of the oral tradition. And I also want to broaden our scope a little bit to look at an aspect of the tradition which maybe oral is not the right term. It goes beyond our linguistic capacities altogether. We'll see how much time we have to do that. Who are the people whose interpretation and understanding of the tradition count? Well, those are the people who know it best. Now, speaking from my own personal experience, when you yourself don't know the subject, it's very difficult for you to distinguish those who are really genuine scholars from those who are only amateurs and from those who are charlatans. Everybody knows, for example, that doctors are not all equally qualified, and some of them are downright irresponsible. We're not fooled by a DR in front of somebody's name. We want to know where he studied. We want to know who certifies him. We want to know from other people who have used him whether he has a good reputation. We'll just take the title DR as automatically a qualification to be used for my medical concerns. When it comes to the little R for RABBI, if you don't know the subject, then anybody who claims the title is one of those rabbis. Okay, there are different categories. What category are you in? If you're a rabbi, you must be a scholar of the Jewish tradition, and you must be competent to understand it and to interpret it and apply it. Well, I mean, I know because that's where I was when I started out. And it took long years for me to discover that the titles are not equal. They do not indicate equal scholarship. Largely because different groups are interested in different types of scholarship. And it's not as if anyone is guilty of fraud or irresponsibility. If you get to know what they stand for and get to know what they think is important, then you'll know what they've mastered and what they haven't. There are certain groups where study of the Talmud is optional or even denigrated. A friend of mine interviewed a student coming from Hebrew Union College here in Yerushalayim who said that she was taking a Talmud course, which was optional, and the professor told her that we're going to show you in this semester just how silly the Talmud is. And that was their brush with the Talmud. She will someday have the title rabbi, but that doesn't mean that she's competent to understand it or apply it. I was at the University of Toronto 10 years ago. I met a student who was doing Jewish studies, and he told me that the reasoning in the Jerusalem Talmud is not all that tight. It's not all that solid. I said to him, "How do you know?" He said, "Because I have a private tutorial with my professor, and we're going through it, and it's just not that solid." So I said, "He happened to have the text there," and he had it. It was like a paperback edition, and he took it out, and I hadn't studied the particular page that he was working on, but there is a very good commentary called the Pnei Moshe, who really lays it out in detail. So I read through the Talmud, and I read through the Pnei Moshe, and I explained it to him, and I said, "I don't see any problems here. I don't see any holes in the logic." And he said, "Well, now that you've explained it, I guess it is okay. You know, he didn't see any either." So I said, "Well, who are you studying with?" "Well," he said, "my professor is someone who got her PhD in Talmud from the Hebrew University." I said, "Well, but she couldn't explain it?" He said, "No, we both went through it and we couldn't make it work." I mean, she couldn't read the commentary on the page that explains it in detail. I said to him, listen, I'm no great shakes in Talmud. That's not my specialty. There are tens of thousands of people on this planet who can learn Talmud better than I can. And I got it at first reading. So I said, you know, finish your degree and then come to yeshiva and learn something. So not everybody who claims a title is certainly competent. To be, in our generation anyway, someone who counts as a scholar and a leader in understanding and interpreting the Torah has to know the whole of the Babylonian Talmud backwards. That's 2,700 folios or 5,400 pages. He should know the Yerushalmi. He should know the major codes. There are people who know these things. Moshe Feinstein once came into shul and he made gave schnapps and cake. I asked him, what is he celebrating? And he said, I'm celebrating finishing the code of Jewish law 200 times. Or maybe it was 300 times. I forget how many times it was. He called up his son once, his cousin, his nephew once said, arrange for schnapps and shul. Why? I'm celebrating finishing, I think he said finishing the Talmud second time. So, this second time? Uncle, you know, you've been through it many, many times. No, he said, I'm fulfilling what the Gemara says, that he who studies 101 times is not comparable to he who studies 100 times. 101 is much more, I've done that twice. He's been through the Talmud 202 times, right? We're talking about a level of scholarship that other people don't even dream of. Once, Rav Moshe Feinstein was in his sukkah, and somebody came to visit him, and they raised the question of Jewish law. And in the discussion, the visitor said, well, I could bring a proof from a Tosfos on this and this page. And Rav Moshe said, it's not on that page, it's on the next page. So the visitor said, listen, it just so happens I'm learning this now. I happen to know where it is. So Rav Moshe said, let's go and see. Now, in the sukkah, they didn't have books. They had to go down, go someplace else. They got. Turned out that Rav Moshe was right. So the fellow said, why was it so important to you to check right away what page it was on? Listen to this. Rav Moshe said, because if I ever forgot what page a comment was on, I could never answer questions by memory again, ever. I'd have to look everything up. That's the standard for answering questions by memory, to never forget the page number that the comment is on, let alone what the comment said and all the rest. We're talking about standards of scholarship that are, in Europe, they used to play the pin game. They would open the Talmud to an arbitrary place, take a pin, and stick it through the pages, and you have to name the words that the pin went through on all the subsequent pages. Used to play that with one another, see how many can get right. They had a mental picture of every page, and every page they could tell you, you know, what the pin was going through. We're talking about something which is just, you know, that's one thing. Knowing what the books say. That's one level. Another is that you have to understand it. It's not enough to have a photographic memory. The Talmud, I would say denigrates is too strong a word, but makes light of someone who just remembers things. He calls him a sack full of books. That's not enough. You have to be able to, now listen carefully, be able to solve contradictions and to raise contradictions, to discover contradictions, and to make interpretations that are plausible in the light of all the information that's relevant, no matter where it's scattered. One has to have understanding, which in our case requires a considerable genius. That's number two. But that too is not enough. It's not enough to remember and to analyze intellectually. One has to live it and internalize it and make it part of one's character. That's a deep point. Why is that so? Why isn't it enough to just study it and understand it? Because what you are studying is a way of life. What you're studying is a way of life. And when you make an interpretation or an application, you are making it for people who are going to live it. They're going to live it in terms of their own psychology. They're going to live it in their families. They're going to live it in their communities. It's going to contribute to the social fabric. If you don't appreciate what that means, and the only way to appreciate the impact it's going to have on a person's life is to be living that life. If you're standing outside of it, it's not going to work. Be like a person who, on the basis of mastery of physics, would study the violin and make suggestions as to how it should be improved. Now, if you use this shellac, you won't have to shellac it for another 100 years. This is a permanent shellac. That would be terrific. And why use that material for the strings? You know, there's much long-lasting, and you could have material that's softer so the fingers don't have to press so hard. But there are all sorts of ways you could improve it. The only thing is, it would sound terrible, right? Because he hasn't listened to it. He's just doing it from the point of view of physics. If he doesn't appreciate it, if he doesn't lived it, then the suggestions in terms of physics are just not going to do the job. Interior decorating. The point of interior decorating is to create a room that will create a mood, a feeling. If it's a room for relaxation, then you want a relaxed mood. If it's a room for activity, you don't want a relaxed mood. You can bet that big corporations pay psychologists lots of money to design the workplace which encourage people to work and not to relax and schmooze and be distracted. The whole surroundings is designed to do that. If you're not a person who works and you're not a person who's capable of being distracted, you'll never be able to figure out what kind of environment you have to create. So the qualification for a person is not just that he has studied it academically, but that he actually lives it and embodies it. And there are degrees of this. Let me share with you a remark that was made by Rav Yaakov Weinberg, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Neir Yisrael in Baltimore. I heard this on a tape of his. He was giving a shiur to a group, and he asked them, how many of you are in favor of refrigerators? So, of course, everybody's hand went up. Refrigerators, they're terrific. Okay, he said, where did you learn that from? From which verse in the Tanakh? From which Mishnah? From which statement in the Talmud? From which Midrash? From which commentator? Where did you learn that refrigerators are good? Well, of course, he got zero. And he said, now I'm going to explain to you a very important concept. What is Das Torah? Das Torah doesn't mean that your understanding agrees with Torah. Das Torah means that your understanding was formed through Torah. It was created through Torah. Not an accidental fit, but that it's an essential fit because your understanding was formed through Torah. Here's an interesting example. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, the Gitzar Livrocha, grew up here in Yerushalayim. And he was born, I guess, around 1900. Maybe a little bit later, when he was, I think, 8 years old, the first automobile came to Yerushalayim. First automobile. Of course, people had heard about it, but no one had ever seen one. And he was 8 years old, and he was learning in Cheder, together with his Rebbe and all the other Talmidim. They heard this put, 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 put outside, and the Rebbe ran out, and all the other students, all the Talmidim ran out. He sat in his chair. He continued to learn, 8 years old, right? Now listen to this. Later in life, he became the main decisor for technology. The Shabbos elevators that you have in various department buildings comes from an institute for whom he was the rabbinic advisor. And all the inventions, the Shabbos telephones and all the rest that are used in hospitals, he was the one who ruled on all of this technology. How could it be that a child who's uninterested in the first automobile would become the decider for technology? Because his interest in technology came from his commitment to Torah and his realizing that the Jewish people needs decisions on technological matters, and he learned the technology. Not from an external fascination with technology. That's what it means to have your mind formed through Torah sources, through Torah experiences. That's where the judgment comes from, not an accidental fit. Just so happens. That's a person who, when you ask for an interpretation, can give you an interpretation which you can rely on. And very often when you read the ideas of people like that, you get a jolt because they think of things. I'm not now talking about knowing something you didn't know, but they think of things that you never would have thought of. And you see that it comes from a kind of grasp, a kind of focus that you don't possess. Here are a couple of examples. A man is on his deathbed. And just before he dies, he says, I want you to take all my money and do with it the best possible thing. And then he dies. Well, there is a mitzvah to fulfill the commands of a person who's dying. Take it and give it to the best possible thing. What could that possibly be? Now, I think if you'll ask a rabbi who doesn't know the answer, he'll say, give it to yeshivas, you know, studying Torah. Ask a doctor and say, listen, if you're sick, you can't study Torah either. Can't do anything. Give it to medical research. And each person will see through the lens of his own experience and his own commitments where the money should go. So Maharam in Rutenberg was asked this question, and he answers, and his comment is cited in the Shulchan Aruch, said, what should you do with the money? Give it to the heirs. That's what the Torah says to do with the money. What could be better than that? The minute you hear it, say, oh, sure, of course. Right? The Torah says what to do with money that isn't otherwise designated. How could you think up something better than what the Torah says to do with it? But when you hear that, you think, I wouldn't have thought of that in a million years. You know, my mind just doesn't work that way. And you see that these people have a grasp. Not because he knew a source. It wasn't written in the Mishnah and Yevamos. That's the way he looked at it. And I realized that his way of looking at it is much deeper than mine. He appreciates it in a way that I don't appreciate it. Rabbi Schiller just told me one recently. During the War of Independence and prior to the War of Independence, secular Zionism had a big impact on the population here in Israel. And a lot of people, even from religious homes, were negatively affected by it. There was a fellow who, along with the others, had his religious commitment greatly diluted, greatly weakened. And he was fighting in the war. And he happened to be speaking to the Chazon Ish. And he said, I'm in charge of a unit that sweeps for mines. And sometimes we don't know where the mines are, and sometimes it's at night. When it's an especially dangerous mission, in my unit there are some who are married with families and some who are unmarried. So I send out the unmarried ones because if a married one with a family will be killed, then his whole family will suffer. Chazon Ish said, that's not Das Torah. That's not Torah judgment. Torah judgment would be the opposite. Because the one who's married and has a family has already fulfilled the mitzvah of procreation. And the unmarried one has not fulfilled that mitzvah. And he deserves his chance to fulfill that mitzvah. Now that again, and by the way, Rabbi Schiller has a regular study partner, comes to him every day, a Yerushalmi, one of the people with the pancake hats and the long coats, you've heard of them? Right, and Rabbi Schiller's chavrusa knows this fellow personally. Oh, by the way, I didn't finish the story. When he heard that, the soldier said, look how far I've drifted. That I couldn't even make a correct analysis of a life and death situation. And on the basis of that, he returned, and he became a teacher in the yeshiva, and he wrote svarim. He wrote books of Jewish research, which were published. And Rabbi Schiller's chavrusa, study partner, knows him personally. That's the one from whom he heard the story. So when you hear that, you realize that it's not just academic learning. It's absorbing the principles into your very character, into your very fiber that's required to be able to understand and interpret. And without that, you don't have the expertise. These are the people who know the sources, who understand, they can analyze the sources, and who can appreciate it on the basis of their own living experience. Those are the people who are qualified to interpret. Now, if I would tell you all the mistakes of people who don't fulfill these qualifications, even though they have high academic honors, it would take us a long time. It's one of the reasons I'm sitting here and not there is because of the egregious errors, error after error after error, which if you know the sources, you can see are totally incompetent. Who are these people? About this, there's not much disagreement. I think identifying the people who are the most outstanding vehicles of the Jewish tradition is no different in principle from recognizing who are the outstanding violinists, or who are the outstanding mathematicians, or the outstanding football players. How do you do it? Well, let's take violinists, right? You listen to music. I listen to music. I've listened to music for decades, and I know some of the people. And I know whom the critics write about, the critics themselves having degrees in music. And I know who aspiring violinists pay money to go to for master classes, at $100 an hour, $200 an hour. They go to these people, not those people. I know who, let's say, the concertmaster of the Israeli Philharmonic, concertmaster is the first violinist, he's the head violinist of all the violinists, right? Who he'll go to for advice on how to play something. So there's a kind of ladder of expertise. I know the people next rung in the ladder. They know people higher above. And then there's public criticism. And in that way, we know who are the top people in any field. Now, is Sarah Chung, who's now one of the great, great violinists, is she number 11 or is she number 8? Okay, so about that, you could have disagreements. But no one will disagree that she's in the top 25, maybe the top 15. It's just, her tone is magnificent, absolutely magnificent. The question of which group are the leaders of the world is not a difficult judgment to make. It's not a really controversial judgment to make. Here, too, you have the people who teach in this yeshiva, and we have the people from whom we learn, with people with whom we study, and they go to people when they have difficulties or problems. Some of us have had the opportunity to learn with some outstanding scholars. Those outstanding scholars tell us that when they have a problem, they go to so-and-so. So there's a hierarchy, and each person knows the person next up in the hierarchy or two steps up in the hierarchy, and then that person says, and this one's even greater than I am. So then you know by that chain who stands at the top. That's how we identify who are the people who are really qualified to interpret, analyze, and apply the Torah that we've received. Are we all together?
Yeah.
Well, don't we have a case in history where all the recognized greats have, you know, said that another great, who we now recognize as great, was wrong, like the Baal Shem Tov, the Rambam, the Ramchal?
Okay, here's a crucial point. There's a distinction between saying that someone is wrong versus saying that he's incompetent to have an opinion. Saying that they're wrong, that happened from the time of Moses. King David and King Saul had a disagreement about a matter of halacha, and each one said the other one was wrong. Saying that somebody's wrong, if you can't take that, you don't belong in this religion. You belong someplace else. Right? Over here, you got controversies, you know, from morning to night. Of course people disagree about things. What is rare, though it does happen from time to time, what is rare is for someone to say the other person is not competent to have an opinion. Usually it's not because he doesn't know, but because his opinions have strayed so far that they're no longer acceptable even as an opinion. For example, the rabbis of Paris burned the Guide of the Perplexed in public. Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed, they burned it in public as a work of heresy. They felt he'd gone too far. Now, even about this, there can be a disagreement. Some will say he's gone too far and it's a heretical view. And some will say he hasn't gone so far, it's not a radical view. And in fact, the Ramban, Nachmanides, spent a good part of his life campaigning for the position that the guide is not heresy. You may not agree that it's correct. That's a difference of opinion which you have from the beginning until the times of the Messiah. But it isn't heresy. And by the time he was finished, everyone agreed that it was not heresy. As the position of the rabbis of Paris was rejected. And everyone agrees that it's not heresy, though you don't have to agree that it's correct. And let's say the scholars don't have to agree that it's correct. So this can happen like anything else can happen. That is, as usually happens when the person's views, according to the critic, the person's views have gone so far that they no longer qualify as bona fide Jewish views altogether. But as I say about that, there can be disagreements as well. And probably those who put the Hasidic movement in a ban had that as part of their reason. And that position is no longer taken by anyone. So that position has left the historical stage. But that's the difference. That's the crucial distinction between disagreeing with what he says, as they say in American social philosophy, I disagree with what you say, but I will defend with my life your right to say it. Right? And that doesn't include yelling fire in a crowded theater. But you know, if you have this opinion, if you believe that people are competent and they are serious and they are responsible, and they disagree with you, so they disagree with you. That's life. Yeah.
What do you think about the idea that you can simply recognize it? You can simply see it in somebody's face, whether they're a god or.
What do I think of the idea that you can just see in somebody's face whether or not he's a god or the leader of the generation? If you are the Arizal, you could see that. If it's you and I think that's absurd. Well, how would you recognize that in his face? There are supernatural powers. If those people have those supernatural powers, they can do it. But in naturalistic terms, why would you think you could see it in his face?
You could just see somebody, say a leader of one sort of Jewish group, a leader of another Jewish group. You can just see from their demeanor, their actions, you can see a sort of, they just look different. You can see that the one is holy.
Well, look, you can perhaps, there's a couple of tricky points here. You can perhaps tell, perhaps, in some, I would say, some simplistic circumstances, you can tell that a person has good character traits. That you could tell. You can see how he interacts with people. You can see that he's not... worried about things that aren't worthy of worry, and whereas we often are worried about things which our better judgment would tell us is not worth worrying about. You could see that about him. But to be a godel, a leader of the generation, that's not enough. It's definitely a positive character, but it's or a positive element in his makeup. But that's not enough. What about knowing the sources backward and forward? What about understanding the sources backward and forward? What about internalizing all the rest of it, not just having a noble presentation? Right? I know people with a noble presentation, but who are very ignorant, and they certainly wouldn't qualify as a. The one doesn't have to go together with the other, so it's certainly not enough. Yeah.
I think that what he's talking about is more or less a preconceived notion that you go into a gadol, you see a gadol, and you're like, well, he's a gadol, and you kind of see within yourself that. Because you already think and that he's higher than, he's holy and higher, you kind of see a holiness in him. But if you wouldn't know
that
he was a gadol, you wouldn't see that same holiness.
Good for you. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. That's very good. Of course, you don't know who he is. There's an interesting split here between Hasidim and Misnagdim. If you go into a yeshiva and you look around, let's say, the davening mincha, right? They're saying the afternoon prayers. How would you know who the Rosh Yeshiva is? Dressed like everybody else, stands there, maybe shuckles a little bit, Okay, everybody waits for him to step back before they start, right? Okay, so you know that way, but otherwise, you wouldn't have a clue who he is. The non-Hasidic world made at least the Ashkenazi non-Hasidic world, made a great deal out of the idea of tznius. Tznius means don't attract attention. Don't call attention to yourself. And very often, there was no way to know. It's a famous story of Solanto when he was on the train. Somebody treated him badly because they didn't know he was somebody special. He dressed like just like everybody else. Didn't wear a turban. And so, how are you supposed to know it? But if you know who he is and you go in with that sense of awe, then you'll experience something there. But you won't see it on him. Hasidim felt that it's more important to share yourself than it is to be anonymous in that way. That's a whole difference of emphasis. But at any rate, I don't think just looking at a person you're going to be able to see these things, unless you have the gift of the Arizal. You can see his spirit when you look at his face. But other than that, no, I don't think so. Okay, now, what I want to do is take this last point and expand it a bit. It's common to think of the Torah as having two sections. The written, which would be the Tanakh, Moses, prophets and writings, and the oral, which is all the rest. That's not really correct, because if you think about all the rest, oral doesn't cover the ground. Oral doesn't cover the ground because there is a segment of the tradition that is not linguistic. It's not put into words. The oral is just more words. Some of the words are written down. Some of the words are not written down. I'm talking about something which isn't in words. And yet it's understood. And it can be applied. And it's objective. It's knowledge. It's information. It's true. It's valid. Even though you can't put it into words. I'll illustrate this briefly. I have a whole shiur on the subject, and I'm not going to give the whole thing to you now, but I want you to have this aspect of what these people who are administering the tradition, what is part of their qualification. When I was in college, in freshman year, everybody had to take English composition because it was assumed that we were only semi-literate, which was pretty close to the truth. I'll never forget an exercise that the professor gave us. She said, I want everyone to take 20 minutes and write down a complete set of instructions for tying your shoes. So 20 minutes is a reasonably long time, and everybody wrote out a complete list. And then she said, exchange lists. Now, she said, use your friend's list and tie your shoes. Not a single pair of shoes got tied. We learned something very valuable from that. You don't store your ability to tie shoes as a list of instructions in your mind. Not only don't you store it that way, you can't produce it on demand. In fact, in rehabilitation or for learning disabilities, there are people who are trained in something called task analysis. They're trained to do this, to write out a set of instructions which is so simple, so direct, so literal that you can do this. I mean, tying your shoes is something like 45 instructions, right? And it can be carried out by a person who's handicapped in various ways. But you have to be taught to do this. You don't do it that way. Nevertheless, every time you tie your shoes, it comes out right. Obviously, you know something about how to manipulate the world to get a result. It's knowledge because we can test it. I ask you to tie your shoes, and you always get the same knot. So obviously, you know something about the world, even though you can't put it into words. A great deal of human knowledge is like that, where you can't put it into words. You try to describe to somebody the difference between a worried face and a depressed face, just in words, where a person's never seen it. It'll be very, very difficult to do. Let him see a few people and tell him, this one's worried, this one's worried, this one's anxious, and he'll pick it up, he'll catch on, because he catches on perceptually. Doesn't do it through words. Ask a good person playing chess, what should I do now? Move the pawn. Why? Because it'll be better. Because I can see it'll be better. Give me a detailed analysis of what it, you know, give me a break. I can see that that's what you need to do. You'll see. If you follow my instructions, you'll win. And you do win. He definitely knows something, but put it into words, that's not where it is for him. A great deal of what we know about the world, we know without using words. Now, there is a segment of the Jewish tradition which also is knowledge without words. We have some indication of this in a variety of places. In the book of Deuteronomy, it says, do what is straight and good in God's eyes. Nachmanides asks on that verse, do what is straight and good in God's eyes. Is this another commandment? We thought there was 613, and a mistake. There's 614. In addition to everything else, you should do what's straight and good in God's eyes. Or is this just a catch-all? Do what's straight and good. How? By doing what the commandments say. We're just telling you that that constitutes what's straight and good. What kind of direction is this verse communicating? Says the Ramban, this verse is communicating something above and beyond all the other commandments. But it isn't the 614th commandment. Rather, says the Ramban, now listen to this, this should sound shocking to you. He says, this verse is talking about interpersonal relations, social norms. And he says it's impossible to write down a complete set of rules governing interpersonal relations. It's impossible. Therefore, what did the Torah do? The Torah gave certain precise rules and expects them to be obeyed precisely, and then said, don't be content obeying just the precise rules we've laid down. In addition to fulfilling all those precise rules, set yourself to do what is straight and good in God's eyes. Now, let's stop and think for a second. it's impossible to write down a set of rules governing, a complete set of rules governing interpersonal behavior. Possible for who? This is a comment that the Ramban makes on the book of Deuteronomy. Who's the author of Deuteronomy? God. So if Nachmanides says it's impossible to write it down, he means it's impossible for God to write it down? That requires a little thought, hey? I believe the point here is this. God could write it down all right, but it would be a trillion pages long. We couldn't do anything with it. He can't communicate to us what he wants from us in terms of interpersonal relations by a book. Okay, because we're just not capable of grasping that much material in a book. So he says, I'm going to give you a few basic, indispensable guidelines. And then after that, don't be content with that. Set yourself to do what is straight and good in God's eyes. Well, at this point, I want to know, how am I supposed to know what that is? So I'm not telling you what it is, but be sure to do it. You know, give me a break. How am I supposed to get off the ground here? And in Leviticus, where it says, Kedoshim Tihyu, be holy, the Ramban repeats the same comment, and he cross-references the two comments and says, here it's talking about personal behavior. Even in personal behavior, it's impossible to write down a complete set of rules. So God says, live according to the rules that I gave you, the precise ones, and then set yourself to infuse your life with holiness in ways that I'm not telling you. Now, how in heaven's name am I supposed to do that if... And then, a third example, and this will be the last example, though there are many, many. Remember what we said about Rosh Hashanah. When Rosh Hashanah comes out on Shabbos, we don't blow the shofar. Why is that? Well, because blowing the shofar is an awesome responsibility and has to be done in a particular way. And we're afraid that people will be worried. They're not going to do it right. So they'll go to an expert, and either the expert will blow for them, or they'll blow in front of the expert and tell them whether they did it correctly or not. And they'll carry a shofar in a public domain on Shabbos, which is forbidden. Okay, so let's analyze what we have here. We have the possibility, we don't know this is going to happen, that a tiny minority will violate Shabbos in the course of trying to do the mitzvah of shofar in the best possible way, which would be the least serious violation of Shabbos that you could imagine. So for the sake of the possibility of a tiny minority inadvertently violating Shabbos in the least serious way, we cancel out the entire mitzvah of shofar for the entire biblical mitzvah of shofar for the entire people of Israel for that year. Who said which is more important than which? How do they make a judgment like that? There's no rule of Jewish law that would dictate that this one's more important than that one. And yet, they discussed it, they analyzed it, they debated it, and they came to the conclusion that protecting that possible tiny minority inadvertent violation of Shabbos is more important than blowing shofar the whole year, the biblical shofar that year. Now, that indicates that there's a source of judgment other than what's written down. Nothing in the written can give you any clue that this should be so. These are three cases where you see that there's a source of judgment, knowing what God wants you to do, that is above and beyond what is written down in any linguistic sources. Where does that come from? Where does this extra dimension come from? Here's an opportunity to make a great mistake. The coming point now is absolutely fundamental. There will be people who will tell you it's just intuition. Everybody has an inborn, natural intuition of what God wants. Isn't that part of the soul? Don't we have a Yetzer Tov, a good inclination? And the good inclination necessarily pushes us in the right direction. If a person will look into himself and see what his deepest feelings are and deepest understanding is, that will guide him in the right way to do what God wants. That is absolutely incorrect. It's absolutely incorrect. And it is extraordinarily dangerous. Because what you end up with then is a subjective system where everybody does what he pleases. I went out into the forest and I sat on the rock watching the water drip down, and it hit me that I should do X. Well, maybe it hits you, but you know, maybe you should hit back. I don't know. Who knows? Who says that it's hitting you makes it right. We have an external objective standard. We have an external objective standard. If it doesn't meet that standard, It could be the deepest thought in your heart, and you just have to give it up. So where does this come from? The answer is, it comes from prophecy. Because prophecy was not just receiving a postcard from God. Prophecy was a total experience. And when a person had the experience of prophecy, he wasn't the same person afterwards. And there's actually a verse in the Tanakh which says so explicitly. When Samuel met Saul, before Saul was king, and he said to him, "Boy, have I got news for you. You have a great future. You're going to be king of the Jewish people." And he said to him, "Go to such and such a place. On the way, you will meet a roving band of prophets," which is what you had in the Jewish hills in those days, "and you too will prophesy. You'll be overturned into another person." When you have prophecy, you don't come out of it the same as you went in. You come out a different person. Now, how many prophets were there? Well, it started out that the whole of the Jewish people, all approximately 3 million, heard God speak at Sinai. They all had prophecy. But after that, for the ensuing 1,000 years, there were 1,200,000 prophets. 600,000 men and 600,000 women. It's not well known, but the Midrash says this in several places. And the Gemara Megillah says it. So, prophecy was very common. At any time, there were hundreds of prophets alive. Which means that every Jew interacted with prophets. So now, you have these people who have this prophetic experience, and their lives are turned upside down, and when they come out of it, they don't eat the same way, they don't walk the same way, they don't talk the same way, they don't study Torah the same way, they don't interact with people the same way. Their whole lives are different. So you live with them, you interact with them, and you see, this is how a godly person does this. This is how a godly person reacts. This is how a godly person relates. And you too can learn from that. Now, just like any other area of learning, there are people who master more of this and master less of this. This is actually mentioned in the Talmud in a way. The Talmud says, "Godol shimushan milimudan." Greater is serving outstanding scholars than learning from them. It's taken from a verse where Elisha poured water on Elijah's hands. That was considered to be a great connection. So Gemara says, greater is serving these people than listening to their lectures, so to speak. The Maritz Chais, one of the commentaries in the back of the Talmud, says, when it says greater is serving them than their learning, it's really talking about two different types of learning. It's a very important comment. The kind of learning you get from serving them is more important than the learning you get from their words. Because what you learn from their character is more central, more important than what you learn from their words. And no other than the Gaon of Vilna echoes this idea. In the verse in the book of Joshua, it says that after Moses died, God spoke to Joshua, and it gives Joshua's qualification. Mesharesh Moshe. Joshua was Moses' servant. And the Gaon of Vilna comments, doesn't say Moses' disciple. It doesn't say Talmud Moshe. It says Mesharesh Moshe. And we know from a pasuk in the Torah, Mesharesh meant lo yomush be'ohel. He was Moses' servant. He was never absent from Moses' tent. He served him morning, noon, and night. He was present with him at all times. And that's why he was chosen to be the leader of the Jewish people after Moses. Of course, it doesn't mean he didn't know Moses' law. Of course he knew it. But there were lots of people who knew it. And this he was unique. So it's not enough that the person has mastered the sources and understands the sources and lives them. But he has to have absorbed this extra dimension of the Jewish tradition, which goes back ultimately to prophecy, so that he embodies that kind of those divine type of attributes that he's gotten by interacting with people who were in that chain, bringing it down from the prophets. And when you have that, then you have incidences where you can look at them and watch them and learn from their holiness and from their righteousness when you know that they've absorbed that. And then you have this, so many stories. A woman comes in to the rabbi Friday morning with a chicken. Is it kosher? It's not kosher. And he sees her come in and glances and he says, I'm busy right now. Wait, please, and I'll get to you. And he's a little talking to his students. Half hour goes by. An hour goes by, and she says, "Listen, please tell me if it's kosher or not. I mean, I need it for Shabbos." And he said, "I know. I realize. You know, just wait a while. I'll get to you." Finally, she said, "You know, the market's closing in a half hour." He said, "Well, in a few minutes, I'll get to you." Right? Finally, 10 minutes before the market closes, he looks at the chicken and says, "It's kosher." And she goes home. So the disciples say, "What happened over here? Why did you keep her waiting?" He said, "Listen, I could see when she brought it in that there was a problem. It's a problem about which there is a disagreement among the decisors. Some say it's treif, and some say it's okay. And I know that in a case like this, when there is strong necessity, you're allowed to be lenient. But if there isn't strong necessity, you're not allowed to be lenient. And I also happen to know that she comes from a poor family. So if I decided 2 hours before when the market was open and when it is possible to get another chicken, so then I would have had to say that it was treif, because it's possible to get. She'd have to go and borrow money, and she'd have to buy another one. It would be very difficult for her. Now that I said it was too late for her to go to the market and get another one, now she needs this one for Shabbos, so she's not going to eat. Then I'm allowed to rule leniently. And that's why I made her wait, and then I was able to say that it was kosher. Now, I have two comments to make. Suppose you were there watching this and walked away without the explanation. What would you say? Saint? The guy's a bum! What do you mean? He kept this woman waiting a couple of hours before he answered her, wasted her time and all the rest. You wouldn't have a clue what was going on. In order to know that a person's actions have a certain moral character, certain spiritual character, you have to know the rules by which he's operating. If you don't know the rules, you can't tell whether it's what its spiritual character is. It's a very, very important insight. It's sort of like watching a game of chess and trying to figure out whether the person who wins was giving the other guy a chance or wasn't giving him a chance. How would you know? Maybe he lost the piece because he just made a lousy move. Or maybe he's so good that he, you know, if you don't know what the rules mean, you don't know what the strategy has to be, you'd never be able to tell. So here, if you understand what the legal variables are, then you could see that this person was applying that extra dimension. In the parlance of the yeshiva, oh boy, I'm going to quit. In the parlance of the yeshiva world, it's called the fifth Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is divided into four sections. And everybody says, what about, but there's a fifth section. The fifth section is sense. I won't call it common sense because it's not so common. You know, having sense, having understanding, knowing how to apply it, knowing what the variables are, the human variables that can't be put into words. Woe to the person who goes to a scholar who knows the book and doesn't have the fifth Shulchan Aruch. Okay.